The following is a unrehearsed interview with Jim Wells of the Red Oak Community in Union Township, Ohio. The interview is being conducted for the Kentucky Oral History Commission. It's September 16, 1983, and we're at Mr. Wells' home. Mr. Wells, tell me about your background and how it relates to the Bible. You know, just really kind of start back at the beginning, going to family. And
all right. Of course, I'm a native Kentuckian, John. I grew up in eastern Kentucky, near Prestonsburg. Of course, okay. at that particular part and time of my life, there wasn't much tobacco involved in it. Because, you know, tobacco in eastern Kentucky is not nearly as prominent as it is in northern Kentucky or central Kentucky or even here in southern Ohio. But after I went to college, which I did go to the University of Kentucky and graduated from there in the College of Agriculture, became an extension agent. Worked in extension service in Kentucky way down in the mountains in Harlan County for about 3 years. And
now, did they do anything with tobacco down in
there? Yeah, we had tobacco in Harlan County, not as much as in Mason County or Brown County, Ohio, but there was, and so I began to work with farmers there and created an interest in it, and of course it grew, and then when I came to Ohio in the mid-50s as an extension agent, we were very much involved in tobacco, and it was a type of a program that I enjoyed and just kept learning and working and developing my expertise in the field. And I worked in Scioto County, which is Portsmouth, Ohio, for about 2.5 years in 1955, 56, and 57, and came then to Brown County, Ohio, which is this particular county where we are now, in July 1957 as an agricultural extension agent. And while here, of course, tobacco is the main agricultural income in this county, several million dollars a year. Just about every farm in the county has a tobacco allotment, nearly.
Let me take you back a little bit and ask a few questions. Now, in those first couple of years, well, first, in go back to the university, what kind of, I guess, tobacco was the main, you know, one of the main topics for your study at that time?
Well, not necessarily just tobacco. The agronomy, in the agronomy program at our universities, like the University of Kentucky, you don't just study tobacco. You study fertility and weed control and all aspects of agronomy, and even into the forages and then grain crops and so forth. But there was some tobacco courses offered, which I did take. But you get into entomology and plant pathology, and they all relate to whatever crop that you're interested in. Of course, I just had a bachelor's degree from there and did not specialize in anything like maybe weed control or plant pathology or entomology in any particular area. But you get the basic background for any agronomy training, and then you go from there.
Now, that was a kind of a volatile time, I think, for tobacco, because I think around that time here, it was the first time they came out with some things about cancer relating and so forth. Was there?
I'm not sure when that first came out. See, this was 1951. I was there in the late 40s and the early 50s in school, and wasn't much said about tobacco health aspects at that particular time. I don't recall. It could have been, but I don't recall any emphasis.
What was the tobacco like? I'm sure, did you, they probably had an experimental crop or whatever. What did tobacco, what was the tobacco like then? Same kind of variety? And
You take, in those early 50s, we were growing varieties then that we are not growing at all now. We had a variety called Kentucky 57 and 58 and 41A and Old Kentucky 16 and and a few of those varieties that we no longer grow. Now, prior to that time, of course, those varieties were breakthroughs. prior to that time, they had old varieties like Judy's Pride and some of those that were not developed as such. They were kind of selections and and those things from growing in the field. But these new varieties at that time, which was those we mentioned, were real improvements. And course, today we don't grow any of those. Mm-hmm. Oh, there might be a very isolated case somewhere that you'd find a farmer that would grow Kentucky 16.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know of any personally, but if right. you talk with some of the seedsmen, and this would be a good topic to talk with the seedsmen.
Sure.
It's like Bill Wilson at Clay's Seed in mm-hmm. Carlisle, Kentucky, or Mr. Rickert at Winchester, Kentucky, at F.W. Rickert Seeds. They deal in just the selling of tobacco seed all over the early producing area, and those would be people that I'm sure could tell you, almost Mr. Rickert could tell you almost to the day that some of these varieties came on board.
Okay. What was the emphasis down in, you said Harlan County?
Yes.
Of course, there were little, but I guess there were little plots of tobacco.
Yeah, well, you know, typically the Burley tobacco program in our whole Burley belt is small.
Mm-hmm.
Back a few years ago when we were on acreage programs,
yes, sir.
I believe that 60% of the Burley tobacco acreage was a half an acre or less.
Gee.
Mm-hmm. So, and then we just transferred that to pounds.
Right.
So I would say today, if you check the stats, I would
still talking about
1,000 pound or less would be the 50% or more.
Yeah.
So we're talking about little farmers, and
right.
and even here in this county, we've got a lot of small growers, and particularly in southeastern Ohio, where over toward Scioto and Lawrence and Gallia counties, we have a lot of small growers.
Mm-hmm.
And same was true down there. They had the little quarter acre patches and half acre patches, and, mm-hmm. and if a guy had 2 or 3 acres, he was a big grower. But it's pretty basic all over the Burley Belt, I think, where you're in Kentucky or Tennessee or southern Ohio, there's the basic allotments are small.
Okay. What kind of, well, for one thing, how did farmers back in the 50s look upon extension agents? What kind of reaction did you get? Were they usually pretty?
Oh, very good.
Uh-huh.
Some of the happiest days of my extension work was down in the mountains of eastern Kentucky, because I was kind of one of them, so
yeah,
to speak,
right.
my kind of people,
yeah.
so to speak. But and for just to give you an idea, John, when I applied for the job and appeared before the county commissioners, magistrates, or the fiscal
yes,
court,
right.
One of the questions they wanted to know of me is, where was I born and raised? If I was a mountain boy, I was pretty well accepted, and if I wasn't,
yeah,
you know.
You're right.
But the attitude toward extension agents was very good.
Mm-hmm.
I've had, of course, I worked for Ohio State University and the University of Kentucky both
mm-hmm.
about 30 years in extension,
yeah.
and my relationship with the farm people through extension has been excellent.
Uh-huh. What was the thrust of your work down there? What was Extension trying to do? I guess the same kind of things now, but was there anything in particular? Were they trying to introduce new varieties or new methods or chemicals at the time? Or?
Well, yeah, you always do that.
Uh-huh.
You always take care of insect problems and disease problems, just like today.
Mm-hmm.
If a new variety came out, you tried to find somewhere you could demonstrate this new variety with a tobacco farmer.
Okay.
And he would try it for the first time, and mm-hmm. you might have a small meeting there at his place some afternoon late and invite some of the neighbors around and say, hey, look, here's a new tobacco variety. Maybe you ought to be trying it on your farm on a small scale.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was about the time in southeastern Kentucky that strawberries were quite popular, so we did a lot of work with strawberries and small
mm-hmm.
fruits and poultry
sure.
projects and,
uh-huh.
oh, gee, I don't know, on and on. It's people that have never lived in the mountains don't really understand. They think that you know, because they're small, they don't do them, but they're just as progressive
mm-hmm.
on those things. For instance, the best gardener, the person who grew the best gardener that I've ever known, was an older gentleman that lived in Harlan County, and today I've never met another person who was as competent in gardening as he was. So,
yeah.
you know, they did a fine job, and
uh-huh.
you worked with them, and they were up to date on in the 50s, just like the farmers are today. You know,
uh-huh.
farmers today are way out in front. You know,
mm-hmm.
they have to be in order to survive, and the same
sure.
was true then.
Uh-huh. What kind of move up, you know, from the Harlan County even up here to southern Ohio now, when you first started working in extension, what kinds of problems, for example, disease, were there any prevalent kinds of diseases, something in particular you were trying to combat?
Oh, in tobacco?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, certainly. One of the problems that we have had continually and still have although we have varieties now that are resistant somewhat to those, the disease that probably goes back the longest of any that I'm familiar with was diseases like black root rot, fusarium wilt, mosaic, and in those early days we had no disease resistance to those. So you had to try to manipulate the growing procedures or the methods that you did to overcome those. Like, for instance, on black root rot, today we don't worry about it because all of our varieties that are released now are resistant to black root rot. In those days, you did not have resistance. So what you did, you let the soil get a little more acid than you would, because black root rot will not grow too well in acid soil conditions. Today, some of our older farmers are carrying over from that because they are just a little bit reluctant to lime tobacco ground up to, say, a pH of 6.4 or 6.5, which we now recommend. Back in those days, you'd never recommend a farmer to lime his tobacco field that high, because if he did, then the black root rot would take his profits. So that has been a tremendous change.
So the agent was involved in coming out and doing a lot of field testing. Soil testing.
As I recall, of course, I haven't been in the county agent position now for about 20 years, but back when I was a county agent, we did a lot of on-farm visitations where you could go right out on the farm with a farmer or with a group of farmers and talk about problems or demonstrate different things. And, of course, today county agents don't seem to have the time to do that because of all the other responsibilities they had. But it was a thing that you had to really work. And with diseases, those were the ones that used to be a real problem. Of course, today they're not.
Yeah. You mentioned the black root rot and what you did with that. Another one was mosaic. Do you remember?
Yeah, mosaic. One of the things that was always recommended, that if you are pulling tobacco plants out of the plant bed, getting ready to go to the field, be careful about smoking tobacco products around, because you distributed the mosaic virus from your hands to the plants, even to the place where they would suggest that you would wash your hands in milk. And I noticed in some publication that I read not too long ago, somewhere or another, they were using some varieties or some types of tobacco where they did not have mosaic resistance. They were still doing that. So, you know, it's something that's still carrying over. But mosaic is a virus, and you can transmit it by just handling the plants. So if you smoked or chewed tobacco while you were pulling plants, and then you could transmit the virus from that dry tobacco from the cigarette or the pipe or the chewing over to the tobacco, and then you transplant it into the field, and you'd have this virus disease.
Yeah.
So, but now we have varieties that are resistant to those. So we're not worried about mosaic. We're not worried about black root rot. We still have it. It's not saying we're not, well, maybe I should say we're not worried about it, but it's not the problem as it once was, because we now have resistant varieties, and through rotations and resistant varieties, we can pretty well eliminate those problems.
Yeah. When you were in that position, what were they doing at that time with, for example, preparing seed beds? Were they gassing then?
No, everything was burned. Usually burned in the fall, or excuse me, in the spring. I don't ever remember a bed being treated in the fall back 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Everybody burned the bed.
Uh-huh. You remember when that transition started coming in? Was that in the 60s?
I would imagine. It came in the 50s. When I came to Portsmouth and Souder County, and over into Brown County here, Ripley area, it was being used, but not to a great extent.
I see.
And through a lot of demonstrations, I know I worked with farmers a lot, put on demonstrations on how to gas a bed with methyl bromide and a few of those things.
Right.
Since then, you've gotten into custom applicators with Vorlex and methyl bromide, where they will use one application, and at that movement down through the bed, they'll apply the liquid material, knife it in the soil, put a plastic cover on it, and cover it all in one operation. Well, back in the early days, when they started using chemicals for control, you had to put the plastic cover on with a shovel. You had to take a shovel and fur out a ditch all the way around your bed, put the material on, and then put the cover over on it and cover it up again. So they made a lot of progress there.
Sure.
Some of the chemicals that we used back in the early 50s was like drenches. We used a lot of drenches. Alcohol was one, Vapam, and a few others, I guess, that you literally mixed the chemical with water and put it through either a sprinkling can or a pump from a barrel on a tractor or wagon and sprayed it on the soil and just saturated the soil with this chemical. Mm-hmm. And they call those drenches, and they did a pretty good job. There were some other materials like calcium cyanamide, which was a dry material that you put on the bed over winter. Now, those were put on in the fall, that one was. You had to put it on in the fall.
So most of these were for weed control, not disease control.
Strictly weed control.
Uh-huh. Now, what they're doing now, is there some...
Yeah, you get both. Like if you use methyl bromide and Vorlax, you not only get weed control, but you get soil sterilization as far as diseases problems are concerned.
I see. Right. Okay. It sounds to me, you know, one of the impressions that people have of farmers is that they're, you know, maybe a little bit contrary, but it looks to me like, and from talking with other people, that if a farmer could see that it would benefit him, they were very adaptable.
Oh, yeah. If you can demonstrate to a farmer that by going to a new variety or a new practice or anything like that, that's going to make him money, he's interested. he's interested in changing. Now, of course, now change is interesting. There's processes of change. When I did my master's work at Ohio State University, I did it in innovations, and particularly with tobacco growing innovations. Mm-hmm. And what I was interested in is the diffusion of information from research to the farmer. Mm-hmm. And you get in this change process, you've got innovators that really are out there seeking information. They're the type
now
of
these
people,
are farmers.
Farmers. Uh-huh. They're the type of a farmer that goes to the researcher at the research station.
Uh-huh.
And you've got another group of farmers that they wait until the information comes down to the county level before it's accepted. Then you've got another group, what we call late adapters, that you've got the innovator who's up there getting it, and then you've got your early adapter who, as soon as it comes out, he's willing to try it. But the late adapter is the guy that says, well, I'll just wait till... see if it really works. I'll wait till you try it, John. If it works for you, then I'll try it.
Right.
So you've got various degrees of adaptations, but the farmer, tobacco farmers particularly, are eager to find new ways and better ways. And I've been just amazed how fast information gets from the inception that the researcher has to the time that the farmer applies it on the land. If you can cut that time span down, and that's what I was interested in as an extension agent with my master's program, you know, hey, this needs to be done.
Sure.
And so I was willing to spend some time doing that.
When were you doing this, your graduate work?
Early 60s.
Okay.
I'd been out of college about 10 years when I started my master's program. I wouldn't advise that, John. I would say if you can go from a bachelor's to a master's in a short time, it's to your advantage.
Yeah. You told me a little bit about that graduate work, talking about the different types of farmers and how they adapt to it. What were some of the innovations that you were particularly interested in then, and how many of them can you remember any of those?
I thought I would never forget after working and writing a thesis on things like that. Of course, my main thrust was that I wanted to find out the channel of communication.
Okay.
And who were these people that John Doe, the farmer out, tobacco farmer, looked to for information? Now, I was not naive enough to think, John, that I, as a county agent, was the only source of information.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that no county agent ever feels that way.
Uh-huh.
Because there are many sources of information and many people who are looked to as sources of information. And I wanted to find out who these people were and how they received this information. And I found out that we have a lot of people out here growing tobacco that are the people that a number of other farmers look to for information.
Mm-hmm.
And they're leaders. They're right at the top. They're those fellows that if you can find out who they are, any new innovation that you have, whether it's a new innovation in surgery with a group of doctors, there's always one doctor somewhere or another that these other doctors go to look for.
Around.
And But yeah. with these tobacco farmers, I want to know who these people were. Mm-hmm. And I did personal interviews, spent a lot of time on farms interviewing people. Where do you get your information?
Right.
What radio programs do you listen to? And if you had a disease problem in tobacco, where would you go? Or if your tobacco was, you was out in your tobacco patch and you found some plants dying, who would you contact to find out what the problem was? And this is a long, drawn-out process, but it works. You can find out who these people are, and then you can go to these people and be much more effective in the process of diffusing information. Yeah. You can't reach the last farmer down the last road individually, but you can do it through other leaders. And this was the gist of my research. And, of course, it covered a lot of things, but basically that's what it was.
So one of the conclusions was that if county agents, for example, could identify these people.
That's right.
Then that was the person you'd work with.
That's right.
You'd
work more with that person.
Sure.
Giving him the latest information or the latest innovations coming out. Now, you'd still work with everybody basis of individual problems,
right.
But when you wanted to introduce a new demonstration or a new process or whatever it was, then if you knew three or four guys in the area, you could get it done much, much quicker.
Were those kinds of people, do they vary from county to county, or do they represent a certain type for specifically, like, are most of them older gentlemen, or are they younger ones, or they have big operations or small
they vary
operations?
They vary all over the spectrum.
Do they?
You'll find that some of these fellows are guys who have master's degrees from colleges of agriculture and are well respected within their communities.
Mm-hmm.
You find some of these innovative leaders are just good tobacco farmers that are interested, have always made their living from tobacco, and just, you've got all kinds.
Yeah.
You might find that some of them are just small farmers,
mm-hmm.
Just happen to have a small farm but does a tremendous job with what he's doing.
Oh,
and they're scattered all over, and this, it's real interesting. But, that's off the subject
bit. No, that's fine. Now, when did you, you made a career change then, you went from an extension agent to?
I had worked in this county about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I came here in 57, and about 1967, an opportunity in our extension service in Ohio, we had a program where they had area centers, and they put a group of area specialists in there and worked with the county agents and farmers in a 5 to 10 county area.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a position that they call an area agronomist, which would cover not only tobacco but grain and forage crops in the area. But basically the major responsibility of that agent was tobacco. Mm-hmm. And of course I applied for the job and got the job.
Yeah.
Worked out of the Hillsboro area center in Hillsboro, Ohio for about a year, and then was transferred over to Jackson, Ohio,
mm-hmm.
which is east of here, 75 miles or so,
yeah.
and worked out of there. But even in those locations, I still worked with the tobacco-producing counties from Cincinnati to Gallipolis, all the mm-hmm. way across the southern part of the state.
Right.
And I worked at that position for a couple, 3 years, and then there was a change in the manager's position at the research farm near Ripley, which does tobacco research, beef cattle research, fruit and forage agronomy type research there.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, they had never had a manager with a joint appointment. It had always been strictly a farm manager with no mm-hmm. extension responsibilities.
I see.
But they offered me the job as a manager of the research farm with extension responsibilities as a state extension tobacco specialist, where I'd work part of my time as a tobacco specialist and the other part of the time actually managing the research farm and conducting the tobacco research and directing the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent the last 15 years of my extension career at that location, which is just close by here.
Sure. Well, let me ask some questions about that then. While you were this area specialist for tobacco in those 2 or 3 years, what were some of the thrust of your work then? Was there were there any developments in particular at that time?
Well, of course, we had a lot of new insecticides and mm-hmm. Fungicides that were coming out. The area specialist job, of course, would just enhance the local county agent. It gave him
sure.
a an individual who was more specialized in the field closer to him, rather than having all the extension specialists located at the college level in Columbus or in Lexington if it was in Kentucky. Here you had a fellow who was just over in the next county at an area center, and we planned programs more concentrated in those areas where we were working. I don't know that there was anything more that we did there than we would as if I had been located in Columbus, except I was closer to the counties, and my area of responsibility was smaller. Of course, tobacco is only grown here in the southern part of the state, and basically here in the southern part of the state. We do have some tobacco that's grown up around Dayton, Ohio, which is cigar-type tobaccos, but most all of our burley tobacco is grown along the river.
Now, when you started here in the early 70s at the research farms, what kind of projects were you working on then? Can you talk about some of those?
Yeah. One of the big projects that we had, and it has been since the farm was established. The farm was established in 1957, basically to do tobacco research. And then along with that, they did the research with beef cattle and fruit and other agronomic crops. We were looking at varieties. We always had variety testing programs where the farmers could come in and look at 15 or 20 different burley tobacco varieties growing side by side, and and we kept information. So then when I would go out and meet with farmers in tobacco production meetings, I could present the information as to here's what Burley 21 cross with Kentucky 10 hybrid did compared to something else. And we had a real good program, still has that program going on, varieties.
Let me ask you a little bit about that. Is there a, do varieties, are they kind of faddish, or do, you know, do farmers do one for a while and another, or do you try to do different plots of land, for example, lend themselves better to different varieties? How does a farmer decide, and you know, what kind of advice does an extension person give a farmer?
Let me back up just a little bit and talk about the process that a variety goes through before it's adapted by the farmer.
Okay.
When the plant breeder, whether he's a university plant breeder or a private company plant breeder, decides that he wants to work on a new variety, from that point until it's available to the farmer, it is about 10 to 12 years, a long span of time, because he has to have a lot of crossings and back crossings in the greenhouse and the laboratory, and then he's got to prove that that variety is a better variety than what's existed. He's got to make sure that that variety has all of the disease resistance built in. Now, we cooperate here in Ohio very closely with the University of Kentucky and all the tobacco research programs, because they've got a tremendous program there, and we don't have very much in this part of the state. So we
This is side two of a tape with Jim Wells. You were talking about how you cooperate with UK and talk about variety development.
Yeah, I just mentioned that from the time that a plant breeder decides to start working on a new variety until it's available to the farmer is about 10 or 12 years, and he goes through a long, drawn-out process of crossings and back crossings and incorporating material into his breeding program that will carry disease resistance.
Now, this is done usually by a university, or do seed companies do this kind of work too?
Back in the early days, only universities did much of this. Most all the varieties that we had were either a Kentucky variety or a Tennessee variety or something like that, where they had the facilities. In recent years, private individual companies are developing their own varieties. They will not release, for instance, the crossings and back crossings. It's kind of a kind of like the corn variety programs. You know, you have a lot of varieties of corn by any numbers of companies, but they, they're private certified varieties. Well, in the olden days, only the universities did the breeding work, but now individual seed companies like Clay's and Rickert's, a lot of those people are coming into developing their own varieties. But we were talking about the research variety program. We have what we call a nursery. When a plant breeder gets a variety, and these varieties to be released, a committee has set up some standards.
Yes, sir.
They have to have disease resistance. They have to have black root rot resistance. They have to have mosaic resistance, fusarium wilt resistance. And let's see, maybe another one. I'll just see. Black root rot, mosaic, fusarium wilt, and wildfire. Those are the four diseases that all varieties must have in order to be released. So he incorporates all this material into it, and he has these resistance, and he wants to put a variety out to be tested for different locations in the growing area for yield and quality and smoke test and cigarettes and so forth. Then all of the universities that grow tobacco, all the states that grow tobacco, those universities and research farms like Kentucky and our research center here at Ripley and Tennessee and Virginia and North Carolina, they'll all take these new varieties that this plant breeder has developed and put them out on a small test. And they'll record a lot of things. They'll record blooming dates, the number of leaves per plant, how tall the plant is when it blooms, how wide the leaves are, how long the leaves are, just an awful lot of information. Then the tobacco is harvested and cured, and then samples are taken and given to domestic cigarette manufacturers, and they manufacture cigarettes from them, and they go through their processes of evaluation, smoke test, taste test, all those things. So let's say out of a group of 20 of those, you might come up with one or two that look real promising.
Yes, sir.
It would meet all the standards. It would be a good yielder and standability. It would meet the farmer's requirements, so to speak. And it would also meet the manufacturer's requirements. Then, then that variety then would be expanded and put into another test and tested further. And maybe 20 would start, and you might be lucky if one ever made it to the farm as a variety that a farmer would use. But one of the tests that's always been real interesting to farmers where you could take some of the 15 or so varieties that are on the market now and see them performed on the same location side by side. And we gathered information like yield and quality and so forth. And then when we would talk with farmers, we'd say, now here is a variety if you're not using. You ought to try. Now, we're not saying for you to go out here and put your whole field out with it, but put a stick row or two down through the field. Now, a stick row, we mean just a couple of rows or four rows or something that you can compare what you're now growing against a new one. And if this new one proves out to be better and higher yielding, and all, then maybe you ought to change. But if the variety you're now growing, it meets all your needs, you have no disease problems, and you're in a good rotational program and so forth, and maybe there's no need to change.
In our Burley Belt here, how many varieties, you know, for example, are popular? Would there be?
Well, we have two types of varieties. We've got what we call the standard varieties, like Kentucky 10, Kentucky 15, Kentucky 14, Burley 21, those type. Then we've got the hybrids, which are crosses between varieties. The hybrids are popular, more popular. There's about, I would roughly say, about 75% of the varieties that are grown are hybrids. And of those, you can narrow them down to about four or five. 2110 is probably a real popular hybrid. That's a cross between Burley 21 and Kentucky 10. These crosses, by the way, are made by the seed producers. The university people don't make the crosses. The seed producers do.
I see. Okay.
And this is part of their process.
Yeah.
The most popular standard variety grown today probably is Kentucky 14. Now, they are both real excellent varieties. No problem with either one of them. So a farmer just decides, you know, I drive a one kind of a car, and you drive another because of our personal likes, and, and this is about the way a farmer, if all varieties are equal, and he has no disease problems on his farm, you know, it really doesn't make a lot of difference. It comes down to personal preference. You know, some guys like blonde-headed girls, and others like brunettes.
Do you find farmers like in different regions, say of a county, all growing the same kind of variety, or do they?
You find different areas of the state.
Do you?
You find some areas of states are more progressive than others. And then you'll find areas of state that have specific disease problems, like this black root rot problem we were talking about earlier. We have varieties that are being used, the hybrids, for instance. carry less disease resistance to black root rot than does, say, Kentucky 14 or Kentucky 15. And you'll find, like in eastern Ohio, over in Gallia and Lawrence counties around Ironton and Gallipolis, Ohio, mm-hmm. where Kentucky 14 may be the leading variety in that yes. area. Mm-hmm. In this area where we live here in around Ripley area, I would say the hybrids are more, but we have more good tobacco land that we can rotate.
Yeah.
You know, we don't right. have to grow our tobacco in the same spot place, over and over right. and over, whereas in that part of the state they do. Eastern Kentucky is the same way. You'll find standard varieties in eastern Kentucky that are resistant to black root rot grown more there than you would, say, around Lexington or Richmond yeah. Or somewhere yeah. another that where they have a lot of land that they can rotate.
Because the hills are just so much arable
that's
land,
right.
they have to
they're just
keep
so,
using that over. Uh-huh.
There's just so much available, and that's all you've got.
Right. Okay, that was one of the, that's one of the things that the farm did. What were some of the other kinds of?
Well, we did a lot of work with herbicides on tobacco, mm-hmm. sucker control materials on tobacco, and fertility. Mm-hmm. Fertility is an interesting thing. You'll find farmers using various amounts and various methods of applying fertilizer, and what we tried to do in the research program there was try all of those and then try to come up with a general recommendation to our farmers mm-hmm. that would say this is the best way you can go. Mm-hmm. And it'll vary depending on weather conditions, but I'd say the sucker control material has been very popular in the past, mm-hmm. herbicides on tobacco, mm-hmm. the variety programs. That's, and we had a curing research project on the farm over there that was interesting because I believe in 1968 a tornado came through here and destroyed about 30 or 40 tobacco barns out here in this area, and I don't have many over in Kentucky. Yeah. And so many barns had to be rebuilt, and we were interested in building a barn for curing that would be a modern barn, mm-hmm. one that was not 5, 6, or 8 tiers high
yes,
and like we see in the olden days. So we built a barn through the cooperation with the University of Kentucky. Dr. George Duncan, the agricultural engineer there, helped us greatly, supplied the plans and everything, and we built what was called a 2-tier forced ventilation barn, only 2 tiers high, but you hung tobacco in it almost double the rate of a conventional barn, but you had fans and LP gas furnaces in the barn that took care of the moisture problem, and that was of great interest to a lot of people. That hadn't been done in this area before. It's although it did not catch on as the way to build a tobacco barn, the principle is still there, mm-hmm. and it's still operating and still does a good job.
Yeah. What about, I was going to ask you about that, I think farmers that build new barns are going to shorter, longer
yeah.
barns?
Yeah, they're barns that are not too high. I think maybe a 3-tier barn is about as high as the University of Kentucky engineers recommend building.
Mm-hmm.
And then as long as you want it.
Sure.
But we still have local builders that still build the old-fashioned 4- and 5-tier high barns. But the problem, John, comes down to labor. We
sure.
just don't have the labor today that we had at one time. And if it is, we can't afford it. And so with 2 people in these 2- or 3-tier barns can just about hang those barns,
yeah.
whereas those 4- or 5-tier barns, you've got to have 3 or 4 people up in
sure.
the barn and one on a wagon. So it just doesn't make sense to build
yeah.
those type of barns.
What about the use of gas and fans? Is the
yeah, we've
cost?
Gone, yeah, we've gone through those different methods. The olden method, years ago, just about everybody that used any supplemental heat at all in a barn was coke.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to man those coke stoves, and a few
yeah.
growers still do that if you can find coke. Coke is difficult to find, and if you can find it, it's expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But we went mostly from using coke stoves to LP gas burners in barns, and that was a great innovation because you had more control of the temperature. You could control it. You could set it and go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
With those old coke stoves, you had to get up and fire those
stay
coke
right
stoves all night long, you know. And you had to be careful not to overheat them because you could set the color in the tobacco. And,
mm-hmm.
and they had some problems. Then we've gone through many years of supplemental heat with gas burners. And just by inflation and the cost of fuel,
yeah.
the gas burners are not economically to use. So
mm-hmm.
we've gone to fans. And George Duncan, the agricultural engineer at University of Kentucky that I referred to a while ago, who's
yes.
always looking at new engineering projects, is recommending the use of fans. And these are large fans. that would be placed horizontal up in the barns about the first tier in the middle vents of the barn that would have a tendency to pull the tobacco, the air out of the tobacco from the top and push it out the bottom.
Oh, I see.
And they worked real well.
Uh-huh.
One of the early innovators, and this is, we're talking about the innovations a while ago, one of the real early innovators with fans in the barn was this Mr. F.W. Rickard at Winchester that I mentioned as being a seedsman.
Uh-huh.
I can remember, a good 20 years ago, Mr. Rickard was using fans in his barns there out of Winchester, Kentucky, and a lot of people came and looked and I'm sure put fans in their barns because he used them so effectively. We've got a number of farmers in Ohio that do have fans in their barns like that and like them real well.
I was going to ask you too, you know, you talked about the different chemicals that you use and so forth. There's a lot of things that farmers can do to their beds and their, you know, during the setting process and the suckering and the, but what about the cost on those? Have you...
You kind of have to weigh the cost of some of these new materials. If by doing one of these practices, and most of them, like on insects and diseases, we feel that the preventative method is much cheaper than the corrective method.
Sure.
Just like this blue mold problem we've had in tobacco in recent years, we say, you know, put on Ritamil before you transplant. Sure, it'll cost you $50 or $60 an acre.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But if you have blue mold and don't have it, you've already lost 25% of your crop.
Yes, sir.
I think Dr. Bill Neesmith, University of Kentucky, who's a plant pathologist and has worked with blue mold quite extensively, he says if you don't use a preventative method and follow the corrective method, when you find that you have blue mold, you can just mark 25% of your crop off because you have or will have lost that much by the time you get it under control. And so...
At the experiment station, do you kind of, financial kind of calculations
now,
too?
We did not do that at Ripley because we didn't have facilities or personnel to do that sort of thing, but they do that at the University of Kentucky where they can, you know, actually calculate the cost and time studies and things like that. I think that most farmers that have had disease problems and insect problems are willing to pay the cost of chemicals to take care of them. One of the things that you mentioned, sucker control, I can remember back when I first came to Ohio was about the time that MH30 came out. And MH30, of course, is maleic hydroxide. It's a chemical that retards the growth of suckers. It prevents cell division in the plant. After you top it, you spray it with this maleic hydroxide, and then no suckers will grow. In the early days, it was thought that the companies wouldn't buy the tobacco if the MH30 was applied. And I have a friend here that I tell the story on him that he was one of the earlier fellows to use MH30 on tobacco. And he'd be down in his tobacco field spraying with a hand sprayer. And he'd hear a car coming down the road, so he'd duck down in the tobacco so nobody could see him. And then after the car passed, he'd get back up and spray on. Well, that's today is one of the very accepted practices.
Sure.
We got big Hon High Boys and other things, commercial fellows who come in and will spray an acre for you in 10 minutes and be on his way for a real reasonable cost. So this sucker control has been a real innovation to the tobacco grower. It's saved him many, many dollars and many, many hours of hard work. One of the more recent things that have come down the pike, so to speak, that has been a help to the tobacco farmer is the method of preparation for market. We've gone basically from hand tying to baling tobacco, and I think as time goes on, it'll be less and less and less, and even today, you know, you don't see many hand tied baskets of tobacco on the market. So this has been one of the great labor savers. It takes us about 300 man hours to grow and market an acre of tobacco, and about half of that is in the market preparation. About 150 hours of it is in the market preparation. And if you can save 50% of that time by baling over hand tying, and many people have done that, time studies at Kentucky, at University of Kentucky, has demonstrated you can save up to 40 to 50% of your labor.
Yes, sir.
Just look at the cost saving involved, you see. And
So
this could help the farmer. And those two things, as I recall, the sucker control and the market preparation has been two real, real labor saving innovations in the last 20, 25 years.
What about the, did you all ever do any work with some of the new mechanization kinds of things, the strippers, and I think a few people put out harvesters? And
yes. Several years ago, there was kind of a trend to try to flue cure burley tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know the difference between flue cured and burley. Burley is a stalk cut,
yes, air
cured tobacco, and flue cured, you take all the leaves off the stalk and put it in a barn or a container and dry it out literally in about a week's time.
Mm-hmm.
We did some work for one of the chewing tobacco companies a few years ago on a project where we brought in a field harvester.
Mm-hmm.
It came from South Carolina, and we had a chewing tobacco project, and we stripped all the leaves off the stalk with this field harvester.
It was
called a once-over harvester. You just take all the leaves off, leave all the stalk stand.
Uh-huh.
We took those leaves and put them in
out in the field. Uh-huh.
Put it in a container and put this container into a portable curing shed, which looks just about like a tractor trailer.
Uh-huh.
And had a furnace apparatus all built in.
Yeah.
And we cured out the chewing tobacco like that, just like they would in the flue cured.
Yes, sir.
And was very successful. Now, we did some burley tobacco at the same time, but I never felt like, and I'm sure the industry never felt like, that burley tobacco cured, flue cured style was still burley tobacco. One of the things that burley tobacco does with cigarettes, it gives it taste and aroma, mm-hmm, and so forth, and it has its own characteristics. And when you remove it from the normal process of stalk air cured mm-hmm position to a flue cured, you don't have burley tobacco anymore. It's just something different. Don't even look like, well, it still looks like tobacco, but it just doesn't look like normal burley tobacco.
Uh-huh. Yeah. The strippers, the mechanical strippers, did they catch on around here? Or?
Oh, we had a young fellow that lives over in Georgetown that developed one of those strippers, fellow named a Ring. He had what he called a Ring stripper. Mr. Jones over in Maysville has a stripper. There's a number of them. At the tobacco festival 2 years ago,
uh-huh,
we must have had 8 or 10 tobacco stripping people who were there with booth demonstrating their product. The tobacco festival this year, we only had 2. So, you know, the idea of mechanization is good with tobacco, and we need to see mechanization, but we just haven't gotten to the place where mechanization fits in with our present marketing system. We still market tobacco by grades.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we would ever get to the place that we would market tobacco in one grade,
mm-hmm,
in unoriented positions,
yes,
in other words, you just run it through a stripper and put it into a bell box and bell it up and put it on the floor, then tobacco strippers will really move.
Mm-hmm.
Until that time comes, there's going to be few of them, I'd say, accepted overall. Now, there's some good ones and some better ones, and I would probably say some poor ones that are on the market.
Uh-huh.
But basically, they're all one-grade strippers.
Yeah.
Now, some of the stripper people, inventors or developers, would probably argue with me, say, well, we can strip it 1, 2, or 3 grades, however you want it. Well, that's true, they can. But when you start doing that, then you reduce your efficiency down to where you could probably strip it off by hand and put it in a bell box just as effectively. So. I don't look at strippers as being a great innovation like the sucker control or the baling process.
Right.
But if we ever get to the place that we just market one grade and mm-hmm, don't pay attention to quality, then they might really take hold.
Talking about the grades, in your work with tobacco in this area, have you seen farmers reducing the number of grades they strip in?
Of course, I don't remember the times that some of these older fellows that you've talked to or will talk to have talked where they used to strip it in 5 and 6 and 8 grades,
sure,
and then they'd size each of those.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember that too much, but I can remember very definitely going from 4 or 5 grades.
Okay.
that we've had down to one grade. We've got farmers today that only strip in one grade. And you can strip some tobacco in one grade. It all depends on the crop, the quality of the crop, and what it looks like.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes two-grade stripping falls very nicely. It depends on the year and on the tobacco itself.
Yes.
Sometimes you can take off the trash leaves and one or two of the lug leaves, and everything else just naturally falls together.
Mm-hmm.
But this, you have to determine this with each crop. You have to bring your tobacco in out of the barn, put it on the stripping bench, and go through and look at what you've got and strip accordingly. I would say most of the people today are stripping in two or mm-hmm. three grades.
Yes,
and less three grades, more and more two mm-hmm. grades, and you see one grade stripping coming along. Now, one grade stripping doesn't mean that it's poor quality tobacco.
I understand.
It just means that on the market, it's graded differently, it's price supported at a different level,
mm-hmm.
but still can be excellent tobacco. And you see a lot of M grades, which they do put an M on it, mm-hmm. selling just as high or sometimes higher than other grades, mm-hmm. depending on the needs of that particular company.
Sure. Mm-hmm. One question I want to ask is, people in Southern Ohio, and I don't know if this is true or not, but do they feel like they're kind of a stepchild? This is a tobacco growing area, but as far as the state legislature and I think some of the politicians, tobacco is not high on their list. In fact, maybe not even supportive of tobacco.
Oh, that's true. Uh-huh. We do have that problem, Zach.
Yeah.
Yeah, it feels you get the feeling down here that the state legislators sometimes, and particularly our legislators who go to Washington,
mm-hmm.
don't look at Ohio as a tobacco producing state and not paying attention to the needs of the farmers.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of tobacco history here, and the Burley tobacco, by the way, that we now grow in all of our Burley producing states originated right here in Brown County,
that's
Ohio.
Right.
And of course that's another story and a long time ago, but the people that grow tobacco in Ohio basically are the same people that grow tobacco on the other side of the Ohio, south side of the Ohio River.
Mm-hmm.
If you'd talk to all of these people, most of them are one or two generations removed from coming from Mason, Fleming, Bracken, Robertson, Pendleton, or
mm-hmm,
some
sure.
of the Lewis counties over here.
Yeah.
But they do feel like, you know, that our legislators kind of don't consider our product that we grow down here. And unfortunately, we have a U.S. Senator, Howard Metzenbaum, who very much is against the tobacco farmer and that he
yeah.
wants to eliminate the program. And,
mm-hmm.
and of course, you know, votes will be the only thing that will change that. And if you take, we've got 11,000 farm families that produce tobacco, that's probably 22,000 votes.
Mm-hmm.
In a state where Ohio has 10 million people, you know, there's no way.
And a bit of much clout.
We don't have much clout.
Yeah.
But we're gaining attention because the program that I'm working in now, after having worked 30 years with Ohio State University and the University of Kentucky in Extension Service, I did retire from those positions, and I've been working the last 2.5 years with Ohio Farm Bureau and R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company on a program we call our Pride in Tobacco program.
Mm-hmm.
And through that program, we are trying to get tobacco farmers involved and trying to get people who are not familiar with tobacco problems to acquaint them with that and the whole program. And we've gotten more attention in the last 2 years, if I must say so, with attention to the tobacco farmer through legislature, through these Pride programs, and
mm-hmm.
it's turning around. We have about a $55 million income down here from tobacco. Now, that's small compared to Kentucky, where you have maybe 119 of the 120 counties in Kentucky
sure.
that grow tobacco.
Grow tobacco.
We've got in Ohio about 23 counties that grow tobacco, some.
Mm-hmm.
And you can narrow that down and say we've got about 8 or 10 that really mm-hmm. depend on it.
Uh-huh.
So we're small from that standpoint, but even though we're small, it's still an awful important item here in the southern part
sure.
of the state.
Yeah.
But we do feel like that, I'm sure the grower feels that the legislators overlook him because it's an inconsequential thing.
Right. What do you think I know, you know, the tobacco program is threatened a little bit and so forth, but where do you think the tobacco farmer is going? Are we going to bigger farms or what's going to happen for him?
Well, I think time is going to take care of a lot of this. You know, as people get older, they're going to work less naturally. And as you get older, tobacco is not easy. I mean, sure. It's a lot of 300 man hours per acre. Now, a lot of older people can do numbers of things. They can if you would go to all the tobacco stripping rooms in the wintertime in this area, and you'll find a lot of women and a lot of older people stripping tobacco.
Sure.
But when it comes to housing time, that's a young man's job, you see. It's hard, it's brutal, it's hot and heavy. And as a result of that, is the natural process of the farmer as he gets older. He does less and less that type of work. He either rents it out or leases it out, or maybe sells the farm and moves to town.
Sure.
And I see down the road a few years coming that these tobacco farms are going to get bigger. If we would happen to lose our present price support program, and I think we will eventually, I don't think there's any question about it, that within the next, 3 to 5 years, we probably will face the possibility of no price support program. Now, that doesn't mean, John, that we won't grow tobacco.
Oh,
there are going to be lots of tobacco grown regardless, and maybe even more tobacco grown if there's no program. But if that happens, then you'll find perhaps, and I'm just guessing, that you'll find a lot of contract farming, where the farmer will contract with a domestic tobacco company, and you'll bypass warehouses. A farmer will grow for a particular company, perhaps big acreage. And if that happens, then the little grower doesn't have a chance, you see. This half acre we talked about, the
which is really the bulk of the program.
But where would you go with a half acre of tobacco if the companies want to contract farm and they're talking 100,000 pounds and 500,000 pounds? And, you know, it's kind of like a program several years ago that we had at the research farm when we were doing research in grapes. You know, 150 years ago, back prior to and maybe during the Civil War times, this was a grape growing area, and it left here because of diseases and so forth. But we tried to revitalize that market with some of our research, and we talked with a big wine producer, Myers Winery in Silverton, Cincinnati. Said, would you be interested in growing or buying grapes here in southern Ohio? Oh, yeah, we're interested. Well, I said, now these farmers could grow, you know, an acre or two of grapes along with their tobacco and so forth. And he said, we're not interested in that. He said, now what would we do with a ton of grapes here on a weekend? That would be a kind of a weekend project. Said, here comes a farmer into the winery with a pickup truckload with a ton of grapes on. So I said, what do we do with a ton of grapes? Now, he said, if we had 1,000 tons of grapes, or 50 tons of grapes, or 100 tons of grapes, then we can talk. So he said, we were not interested in talking to the small producer. We want the 50-acre, 100-acre grower, where you'd use a grape picker and mechanize the whole bit. Well, I think the same thing would come in the tobacco. After a while, the small grower would gradually quit, and it would finally wind up in the hands of those people who really like to grow tobacco, who want to mechanize as much as possible and get as large as possible. We've seen the same thing in grain. You know, we've got big tractors and big combines, and that can only be done on big acreage, and I think some of the things in tobacco would go that direction.
Thanks a lot for talking to me.